Blog Talk Radio.
In Dallas, Texas, on Monday, July the 11th. We're in the middle of a heat wave, to say the least, 100 degrees. So nothing changes here in the month of July. We'll be chatting today, as we always do on Mondays, with our good friend Bill Katz, the editor of Urgent Agenda. There's a big story in New York about this bodega incident where a confrontation between the owner and a person who was attacking, and it's a big story in New York. It's a big story everywhere, really. So we want to talk about that with Bill, but let me begin by asking Bill, what's the temperature in New York? I bet it's not 100 degrees, Bill.
Well, you know, as usual, I come unprepared to talk about the weather because I don't experience it. I haven't gone outside yet today, but it actually, I just looked it up, it's 83 degrees where we are.
Well,
so considerably cooler. That's a cool way for you.
Yeah, in fact, it's supposed to, that's what it is in the mornings.
Yes.
81, you know, when I go out to get my newspaper, I'm the only person on our street who still gets a paper, Bill. So that
used to be
tells you
a
something
great
about where we are. Yeah, I mean, I all my life, get up in the morning, go out and get a newspaper, and I would look down the street and see all these other copies, you know, once in a while, you
right.
know. There'd be some of them, a couple of them were kind of together because the fellow who throws the paper missed his target. But now I look down the street and I just see grass. I don't see any. So, but we're going to talk about the media too, because they've been hard hit by some confidence problems that the American people have. But let me begin with the bodega story. Now, in the interest of full disclosure, I grew up going to bodegas. That is a big part of growing up, whether it's in Cuba or in Puerto Rico or wherever. You have these little bodegas at the street corner, and your
yes.
mother would send you to the bodega to get this or this or that. And
it's still,
you know, I just have memories.
That still
yeah,
goes
it's
on.
It's part of life. That's still going
yeah.
on. So, I, you know, when I think of a bodega and I think of the bodega owners or the men, you know, or families who run these things, I mean, I have good memories of that because that was part of growing up, and generally it was a family who owned the bodega, and they were part of the neighborhood. And anyway, so you had an incident in New York, Bill, and if I get it correctly, please correct me if I'm wrong, but if I get this, some lady walks in, gets into an argument with the bodega owner, and then her boyfriend jumps over, right, and gets into a fight with the bodega owner, and then he takes a knife, and I don't think he meant to kill him, but he killed him. And now then on top of that, the bodega owner is 61. The guy he was fighting against is 35, and he's a career criminal. And the bodega owner is the one in trouble, Bill. Can you help me explain this or understand this, Bill?
Well, this is something that people couldn't grasp because it was ridiculous. And the fact is it's on videotape, which made it even more ridiculous. Some guy, as you said, comes into the store. A woman comes into the store. She has a confrontation with he actually wasn't the owner, he's the clerk. And apparently there is some dispute between them. The woman stomps out, says something that I'm going to bring my friend. A few minutes later, she comes back with this young fellow who, as you said, has a criminal record and is not a very nice guy. He goes behind the counter to confront the clerk, apparently makes a number of threatening comments, apparently tries to pull the clerk around to the front of the counter, a physical confrontation. And the clerk gets up, and as he is being led by this guy, from what I can see on the tape, this is my interpretation of the tape, around the counter, the clerk, obviously frightened for his life. I mean, this is not a nice guy he's dealing with. Sees a knife on the counter. It may have been there for security reasons. Takes it, and according to the story, stabs the aggressor. Now there is an alternative version of that, saying if you look at the tape a little differently, you can see that the aggressor, the bad guy, stabbed the clerk first. That is something that is hard to tell from the tape. But the clerk, obviously under attack, stabs the aggressor. The aggressor dies. The clerk is arrested for murder. And they throw the book at him. They wanted $500,000 in bail. They locked him up in Rikers, which is one of the toughest and meanest prisons in New York. And what he was doing was defending himself. He was not the person who was trying to start trouble. He was the recipient of the trouble. And the case went viral immediately because in the prison of Manhattan, the Bureau of Manhattan, we have a DA who's one of the Soros-appointed or Soros-financed DAs. Soros gave him a reported $1 million for his campaign. He's soft on crime. The very first day in office, he made it very plain that he was going to be a Soros-financed DA like the ones in California. Different procedures. Let's get him out of prison. And that is how he has proceeded. So when this event happened, that immediately came up. And the fact that his people went into court and wanted this guy locked up in Rikers with no real possibility of being released on his own recognizance because the bail requirement was so high, nobody could meet it. And this is another area because under his reform regime, this DA has either had people arrested with no bail required for their release or very little bail required. And here is a guy defending himself, didn't want to start any trouble, having the book thrown at him. Well, the story went viral immediately, and the videotape went viral immediately. The videotape was apparently from the store security system, and it has created an absolute uproar. The mayor, Mayor Adams, went to the store the next day to investigate on his own. Mayor Adams is a former New York City police captain, and he said the man who was imprisoned did everything right. He was following the law. And, of course, the story has now spread. Now, is there a racial component to this? Yes. The clerk is Hispanic, has been in this country many, many years, has an absolutely clean record. The aggressor, the alleged aggressor, we should say that, is black. The district attorney is black. And this has created an uneasy undercurrent as to whether there's racial prejudice here. So apparently the wheels began to turn. The publicity was bad. So they were able to spring the guy the next day from Rikers Island, which is, as I said, a very tough prison. And he's back at home. I don't know. I think the bail was dramatically reduced by a judge to something like $50,000, which the clerk was able to raise through the usual bail system in New York, bond system in New York. And there it stands. He is still being charged with second-degree murder. And that is where the outrage is. We have gone through a year of this district attorney with people committing the most horrible crimes, or at least allegedly committing those crimes, being arrested by brave police officers, and 5 minutes later they're back at the police precinct getting their property and just released, show up in court on such and such a day. And we have a growing crime problem, growing violence problem in New York, and this new case has reminded people of previous cases where people doing the right thing have wound up in trouble. And some of those previous cases, which occurred in some cases 20, 30 years ago, were the things that triggered a war on crime that was launched by Mayor Giuliani when he became mayor in, I believe, 1993. And people you read the newspaper stories about this latest case in the bodega, and people say, yes, I remember that case. I remember the other case of a guy, the Getz case, because that was his last name, of an innocent passenger on a subway train who was accosted by five thugs, young thugs, and he shot them. I don't think any of them died, but he was arrested and he was tried. I don't recall what the outcome was, but people said he was simply defending himself. And it has raised the hackles again of New York. You know, there's that one case that comes along out of many that just gets to people. And here is a story of a clerk who has been an honest businessman, who's been an honest employee, never had anything on his record. He was trying to reduce the situation, to quiet it. The tape that was done by the store has a soundtrack in which he's saying, man, I don't want this, I don't want this, trying to lower the tensions. And apparently the alleged assailant attacked him, tried to drag him out to the front, as we said before, and the clerk stabbed him. And the clerk winds up in prison. So
that's remarkable.
It is a remarkable story because if it would have been a normal DA, people would have said, okay, it was a mistake. Somebody made a mistake here, and let's correct the mistake. No, they're not admitting any mistakes. They're not admitting anything wrong at all. And that's what the story is.
Yeah, no, it is absolutely astonishing. The whole country's talking about it. It's not just New York.
Yes.
I mean, the whole country's talking about it. And because when I heard it, you know, I guess I've always had a friendly disposition to bodegas because, as I say, I grew up, you could still see them in L.A. And anytime you fly to Mexico or go to Mexico, particularly in the small towns, you know, these bodegas are everywhere. So I've always had
We have one right here around the block, Tupéis. And the Tupéis is a very famous little bodega, and they're open to all hours. And I can always go in if I was watching a television program and buy a bag of popcorn at the bodega.
Right.
And it's called the bodega. So.
Right. And when I was a kid, you know, we used to go to the way it worked in, this is pre-Castro Cuba, of course, the way it worked is that, you know, your mom would call the bodega and they would bring something over, and I guess she must have had credit there, or we had credit there, because once a week or twice a week, my dad would walk over and I would walk with him. And I remember this so vividly. We'd walk over to the bodega, and he would clear the account, I guess, pay, and then get a cigar and a little cup of coffee, and he'd be talking to the bodega owner like they were great friends, which they probably were, Bill. I mean, but everybody just loves this place. So when I heard about this, I felt so bad for this bodega owner. So I'd love to see this go to a jury, Bill, because the jury would be on this guy's side 100%, Bill. I don't even know how they can get a clean jury, because I don't know if they can ever find a human being within 200 miles of this place that would be a jury that wouldn't be in favor of the bodega man.
Well, you know, that's a very interesting point that you bring up, because it is New York, and you have intimidation by ethnic group in New York. You have these this is one of the centers of political correctness in the United States. So it is possible that you could get a mixed group a jury which would be hung. You know, you wouldn't get a conviction, but you could get a hung jury. You know, as the word gets passed, well, you know, you gotta vote this way, you gotta vote that way. I mean, look at the O.J. Simpson jury in Los Angeles. The man was plainly guilty, and yet he was acquitted. We've had a number of cases of real miscarriages of justice in New York. A case in Brooklyn in the Crown Heights in the 1990s, where the person on trial, the alleged killer, was caught with a bloody knife in his pocket, was identified by the victim before the victim died, and he was still acquitted, and the jury took him to dinner. Well, it was a racially charged case. So you can get these very bad cases, but this one, I don't know how it's going to be resolved. I don't know if the DA is going to cooperate, because in New York, this is interesting, I think, we don't have a recall system. We in New York, if you want to recall a district attorney, you have to have the permission of the governor. And this governor is beholden to the political left. But that's the way it is. You can't. It has to have her approval, and she's not going to give her approval.
No. I just think it's so. This whole story, and everybody's talking about it, it's so crazy. But it cannot be fun for Democrats outside of New York to run, you know, because they're going to get this question about law and order and about this guy. And if you're a Democrat, how do you answer a question like this? There's no possible way you can defend the guy who was, you know, who's a career criminal, who was trying to hurt the clerk or whatever. There's so many problems here for the Democrats in a year in which this is a big issue with the country. This is exactly, Bill, the kind of issue that could just, you know, blow the Democrats wide open on this charge of not being tough on crime, Bill.
Well, absolutely. And the mayor is caught in the middle here. The mayor knows what the right answer here is, and that's to release the guy. But the mayor also is a Democrat. He is also not in this chain of command with the DA. He has no power over the DA. The mayor is trying to build a record here in New York City. He wants to run for president, he said, Mayor Adams, on the basis of what I don't know, but he wants to run for president. We have a governor who's up for election this year, not re-election, but election, because she was the lieutenant governor under Andrew Cuomo, and when he resigned, she became governor. So she still has not won her first gubernatorial election, and she is dealing with a situation where there is outrage in the community and state over the case, and yet there's another side which represents the radical left of the party, and they're not outraged. This is almost a novel.
Well, a novela, right? It would be like,
yeah, you're right.
Novela, the kinds of novelas that they sell at these bodegas. But it's so outrageous. The whole thing is so outrageous. Now, I have a question. What was the lady arguing about with the clerk? Have you been able to make that out?
Yes. They were arguing over a credit card failure, that she apparently wanted to pay her bill by credit card, and the card bounced. And I don't know what the story was after that, but it was about the credit card. And I don't know if she tried to take merchandise away from the store and you know, after trying to pay for it and failing to pay for it, but she did say something to the effect that I'm going to get someone. So that's where we stand.
This lady's judgment should be brought into question. It seems to me that if you have a problem like that, you don't bring into the situation a career criminal. You bring in maybe I don't know, your priest or somebody else, you know, but to actually bring in a career criminal into a situation like this, that doesn't show me she's very smart, Bill.
Well, you know, that's an interesting thing, because that was brought up, and some commentators made the point that crime has become so brazen in New York, so open, that a career criminal can go into a store and do something like this. You've seen the tapes from New York of street shootings where a car, you know, drives by and somebody starts shooting. We had a situation a few days ago in New York where a black Mercedes, I mean, at least the criminal had some taste, a black Mercedes passed a very, very ritzy area of Manhattan, not a crime-ridden area at all, and fired three shots out the window. Maybe he was simply clearing his gun. Maybe he was practicing.
That's right.
But nobody got hurt, but nobody got caught either. He wasn't caught.
Right.
But the openness of the crime, the tragedies that occur in the subways where last year, I believe, what was it, 8 people who were shot on one subway train by an out-of-control guy. Fortunately, none of them died, but they were shot, and it was just out in the open. And that, I think, is what's stunning to people. Now, there are people who argue, well, it's all, most of it is in a few neighborhoods. Well, the people in those neighborhoods have a right to live also. And we had a tragedy of a few days ago on a subway platform in Manhattan where two young boys who knew each other, I think one was 15 and one was 14, got into an argument on a subway platform, and one stabbed the other to death right out in the open.
Right. Yeah, no, it's unbelievable. It's unbelievable. And you know, looking from a distance, okay, and I realize that I'm not there, But looking from a distance, what it looks like to me is that the criminals are not afraid of the police, or they're not afraid of any, you know, they're, you know, I don't know. Once upon a time, I would think that, you know, what would have happened is that the career criminal would have said something like, look, I don't want to go in there because, you know, I've got a temper and I don't want to go back to jail or something like that. You know, but it just seems to me that these people are out in the street. They don't have any regard for anything. And, you know, this poor clerk was put in the middle of something. I'm sure that other people in New York can identify with this, Bill, because it could have been any clerk at a bodega in New York, Bill.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, that is what exactly the way people feel. It could have been me. It could have been a relative. 10 years ago, New York City was the safest large city in America as a result of the work done by mayors Giuliani and Bloomberg. I don't know where it stands statistically now. The statistics may not have changed all that dramatically, but the sense of danger in the city has changed dramatically, in part because of the riots during the George Floyd situation, the fact that stores were broken into, destroyed, with nobody paying a price, and the whole atmosphere that was created by the de Blasio administration, Bill de Blasio being the former mayor who had a Marxist background, a real lefty, and is now trying to win a congressional seat. But people today, for the first time in a long time in New York, really are scared.
That's it. No, that's exactly right, and that's the problem. They're scared for a reason. They're not making it up. They're scared for a reason because they see what's happening, and they see these criminals just running wild. And, you know, these are not criminals that want to argue with you about whether or not the pitching change in last night's game was right or wrong. These are people who want to kill you. And
that's,
you know,
right.
people have a right to be very angry. So I just, you know, the whole country's talking about it, and I know that people here are talking about it, and I just hope that the poor clerk can get his life back together. But I don't know how he does that because, you know, you don't know that there might be retaliation against him from whoever this career criminal was hanging around with. I mean, it's something to think about, Bill.
Absolutely. I mean, what we're talking about here is not only events, but attitudes toward events. And the attitudes of so many people on the political left is, well, they're not really criminals. They're victims of society. And we have to understand, and we have to change our procedures. And let's defund the police, take the money away from the police, give it to social service, and maybe we can avoid this. Well, the problem is every time that's been tried, it's failed. The criminal needs to be locked up. And
right.
And that is the attitude that New Yorkers came to in the early 1990s, and you had a Republican mayor elected. Now, we could have had a Republican mayor this time, but the Republican Party in New York is the kind of a party that concedes an election before the election is held. I mean, they, you know,
before the primary.
Me. Yes.
They conceded before the primary, you know. So.
That's right. Their attitude is, look, I'm on the course. I'm on the ninth hole. It's a critical
right.
game, and you want to bother me with a murder. And that's their
right.
attitude. And I think the right Republican candidate, now maybe the right Republican candidate wasn't available, could have been elected, but New Yorkers are like zombies politically. I'm talking about the city, not the state. They go to the polls and elect, unless they're given a compelling reason overwhelmingly, which they had in the early 90s, they will elect any Democrat on the ticket, including those who are in cemeteries. I mean, it's like
right.
Chicago. You know, you don't have to be alive to be a candidate. You just have your name on the ballot. And it's true. They elect the worst people. Now there is some talk of some changes politically in New York, but the immediate goal, the immediate objective is to get rid of the governor and replace her with Lee Zeldin, who will be the Republican candidate and who is on the right side on all these things.
Mm-hmm.
Whether that can happen, I don't know, because come November – The Democrats come out of the woodwork in New York City, and no matter how many votes are available to the Republicans upstate, the Democrat has that downstate advantage, that downstate vote.
Mm-hmm.
So let's see what happens this year. I don't think there's been any public opinion polling yet on the general election. I think there's been some on the nominating process. The nominees have not yet been absolutely named in New York. I think the primary is sometime in August. Being New York, it'll probably be held between 3 and 4 a.m. in the morning, and they'll announce the vote before the election is held.
Yes. No, but I if this doesn't do it, then I don't know what will do it, because this was such an unbelievable story about this bodega incident. Bill, I wanted to bring this up. You know, the New York Times ran a story here recently talking about this lady, Maria Flores, who was elected in South Texas as the first Hispanic Republican in that area. And they ran a story branding her as some kind of a right-wing extremist.
Yes.
And they're saying that her campaign themes were that, you know, I think her campaign was God, country, and family or something like that.
Yes, that's right.
And you know, that apparently is now very extreme. You know, that's an extreme slogan. And then in South Florida, you may not be familiar with this, but in South Florida, the George Soros people are trying to buy some radio stations, and one of them is a radio station that is very conservative, very anti-communist, where, you know, let's just say it's a right-wing, but conservative station, primarily anti-communist station that really caters to Cubans. And they have a lady there who's a very popular host who refused to stay on the station because they were bought by Soros. So these two ladies have sort of become, you know, the latest two examples of, you know, right-wing extremists. And they're driving the left crazy, Bill, which is sort of funny for me to watch. But I remember, Bill, 10, 20 years ago, if you went down to South Texas, Democrats were running for office talking about God, faith, and country. And nobody said they were extremists when they did that, Bill. So what's happened? Why has that all of a sudden become so extreme, Bill? Maybe that's kind of a rhetorical question, I know. But I find it amusing in a way, Bill. They must be really scared of the Hispanic vote if they're running stories like that in the New York Times, Bill.
Well, I think they see the polls, and the polls show that a Democrat would still win a majority of the so-called Hispanic vote, but not by much. And at some polls, they actually have the Republicans winning. That was at one time the Hispanic vote was considered a safe and very important Democratic vote. But over the years, as the story is told, the Democrats started taking the Hispanic community for granted and made it very plain that they favored other groups in the coalition. And Hispanics, shockingly, actually got angry at the fact that they were being ignored. And what is this, said the Democrats? How dare you get angry at us? What is wrong with you, senor? Do they say senior? You know, it's
gotta be careful with that, because
Yeah,
because you have the first ladies down here in Texas, I guess today, at a Latinx conference.
Oh,
which
God,
you have to wonder. Yeah, you have to really wonder who made up that schedule, who accepted that invitation. But that's another. I mean, that is a term that most Hispanics find very offensive for good reason, because most Hispanics understand that there's a difference between man and woman, and you know, that gender actually does exist. Latinx is very offensive, unless you are AOC or something like that, Bill. But, yeah, I think they're scared, and they should be, Bill.
Well, these are, you know, the extremism is on the left, obviously. The New York Times describing this woman as a right-wing extremist. I've seen her interviewed. She's anything but. She's a traditional American woman of Hispanic background. She sounds like a lot of other women I know. Of different groups. And you know, isn't it shocking that she's so right wing she speaks English?
I know. It's amazing. It's crazy, these people, the way they react. I've seen this lady. I didn't know much about this lady, Myra Flores, because, you know, we're 500 miles from the border. People forget that. That we're in the Dallas area, we're 500 miles away from the border, so we don't stay on top of everything going on down there. We read about it, but I had not actually seen this lady. I've seen her on TV several times. She's awfully impressive. this
she
lady.
Certainly is. She certainly is.
She speaks well. She and then I thought it was funny because I thought Representative Flores, you know, the lady who just got elected, said this. Speaking of whoever wrote the article at the New York Times, she said she doesn't understand our community. I think that's being
right, polite,
Bill.
Yes. Well, that's the point, and that is the point being made by a number of commentators, that the Democratic Party doesn't really give a damn about these communities. They're just useful on Election Day, and then they're forgotten in between. I mean, even as you said, the term Latinx is not a term that actually came out of the any Hispanic community. It was probably assigned by some college professor. You know, they come up with a word. They come up with
right.
a word, and they become famous for inventing that word. You know, and
right.
and that's it. It's
right.
It's,
no, you're right. That's probably where it came from. It came from some. You know, liberal college professor who,
that's right.
I don't know, was trying to impress somebody and came up with that word. And then, you know, people in South Texas or in Florida, they go, what's a Latinx? Is that
yes.
the name of a new battery or is that the name of a new electric car? What the heck is a Latinx? And they don't know.
And also, this has happened with other groups. I remember back in the 1960s, the African-American community went through all kinds of changes. When I was growing up, it was entirely proper to refer to a person, what we would call a person of color today, as colored or a Negro. And it was accepted in those communities as, well, that's who we are. That's, you know, what our heritage is. Obviously, some racists had other words that were not acceptable. But all of a sudden, this became unacceptable. And the first thing was black. And I know a person, people in that community who resented it very much. I know one woman, highly educated woman in that community, who told me, I'm not black, I'm brown. And I don't like being assigned a color. And she didn't like, a lot of people didn't like it at all. Then that didn't
right.
work for a while. Then Jesse Jackson, actually, I think, was the one who came up with the idea of saying African American, because he said that's where we're from, and that
mm-hmm.
that actually caught on. Although now if you say anything but African American, you're called bigoted or a person of the past. And what is so strange about it is the term colored is no longer considered appropriate. Okay, people should be called what they wish to be called, but the fact is, the NAACP is still the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People.
Right.
And
they haven't changed that name. You're right.
They haven't changed that. And the United Negro College Fund is still the United Negro College Fund.
Right.
So,
that's
you know,
right.
as I said, I think people should be called what they wish to be called. But all these name changes had absolutely no effect on the life of one person. Not one
child. That's exactly
child,
right. No, you're right.
Child,
let me take a quick break, Bill, and we come back we can continue this because you're exactly right. I mean, nothing changes. It's just name changes. That's all that it is. We're going to take a little break and we'll be right back. This is Silvio Canto in Dallas, Texas, having a very nice conversation today with our friend Bill Katz, the editor of Urgent Agenda. You know what's interesting, Bill? You were talking about colored people. I grew up with Spanish saying the same thing, but in Spanish. I mean, Cuban blacks were called colored people.
Yes.
Caribbean blacks were called colored people, and it was completely acceptable. I can understand that. You know, maybe later it could be, you know, looking back at it, you know, maybe it could have been derogatory. I don't know. I mean, I don't like to offend people, so tell me what you want me to call you and I'll call you. But it's just crazy. It's just crazy what is happening. But with Hispanic people, it's it's even more complicated because Hispanic people, as Democrats are finding out, actually come from with different colors. There are black Hispanics. There are brown Hispanics. There are white Hispanics. There are Hispanics who look like people from Finland. I mean, they come in all kinds. And, you know, they don't like to be branded one way or the other, Bill, naturally so. So the Democrats just don't know what they're getting into with all this identity politics, Bill.
Well, identity politics has to go. It is doing enormous damage to the United States. Let me just cite an example. Recently, a Supreme Court seat opened with the retirement of Justice Breyer, and President Biden, in what I thought was an absolutely disgraceful display of both pandering and really un-Americanism, said, "I will name a woman of color to the Supreme Court." Now, we fought in the civil rights movement for the exact opposite of that, that color would not be a factor in American life, that you would be judged by the content of your character and not by the color of your skin. And here he was basically saying to anyone outside the community of women of color, you are not going to be considered. Now, put yourself in the position of a member of some other minority group, an Asian American, a Hispanic American, again with the hyphens, with a Jewish American, whatever group, what they must have thought of that, to say, I am not going to be considered because of my race or my religion. Isn't that what we were fighting against? And here it was, he said, I'm going to appoint a woman of color. All the people on the left applauded, and he appointed Judge Jackson. And I remember that when he made the appointment, in my view, it was so insulting to her because she betokened. She became a symbol instead of a person with a distinguished background, which she has. Her credentials can stand on their own. She doesn't need the help of identity politics. And I felt it was very, very demeaning to her and to the African-American community. It was pandering. And he should have, what he should have done, and Daniel Patrick Moynihan once spoke about this, he advocated that discussions of race deserve some benign neglect. He was called a racist for saying that, but what he meant was the more you talk about it, the worse it gets, that the people come out of the woodwork, they get offended, and the idea is to simply do the right thing. If the president felt that it was time for a woman of color to be on the court to perhaps correct a historic wrong, he should have simply appointed her and let her stand on her own background, which is distinguished. It would have been a much more impressive appointment than to make it into a political appointment, which is what he did.
Right.
I did.
Well, I wonder how Clarence Thomas felt about it, because last time I checked, he's a person of color, isn't he?
He is. Well, they want to ban him. The African American leadership does not consider him a person of color, and he's married to a white woman, and he's conservative. He doesn't follow the party line, and they despise him. At least the leaders do. I'm not so sure. If you took a poll in the African American community, I'm not so sure what the feeling would be about him. I would suspect it would be a lot more favorable than what's coming out of the mouths of so-called black leaders.
I agree.
Much admired man.
He is, and he's a very capable man who had a tremendous life story. And, a lot of young people should look up to his example. And, frankly, this Lady Jackson who just went into the court, she has a great story, too.
I mean,
we may disagree politically, but she has a great story, too. And that's the way it should be. It's your life story, not so much obsession with skin color, which is everything going on the other side these days, is about, you know, what group and skin color and gender. And, of course, with gender, it's 57 different genders, which makes it a little confusing. I hate to be the guy who has to come up with a sign for the bathroom, you know, because it used to be men and women. Now I guess you need 57 different signs. But let me get to another. Yeah, I mean, you don't want to offend anybody, you know, that's for sure. Let me get to because time is flying, and I wanted to get to a topic here that is very important, and that is that there appear to be two things that are dropping very fast. One is President Biden's approval ratings, and trust in the media. They're dropping both very fast, and I can understand why President Biden is dropping. I guess people are unhappy. I can understand why the media is dropping. Look, just look at the way they cover stories. But I don't think it's good for a society when you don't have trust in the media, because then what are people going to believe? And you're also going to have another problem, Bill. I want to get your reaction to this. When people don't trust the media, then they try to get the news from a lot of different places, and I'm not necessarily sure those places are better. You know, a lot of people are getting their stuff from the websites now. Nobody's editing the stories. Nobody's fact-checking anything. People just believe a bunch of things because they saw it on a website. So I'm not sure that's better, Bill, than you know, than having a media that people respect. Anyway, kind of a long-winded question, but I wanted to get your thoughts on that, Bill.
Well, the decline in trust in media is not something that started yesterday. We have, first of all, always throughout the history of the country had mixed feelings about the media. In the 19th century, it was very common for a newspaper to be associated with a political party. It was considered proper. You know, we represent the Democratic Party position. In the 20th century, a man named Joseph Pulitzer came to light, which is why there's a Pulitzer Prize, and he decided that journalism had to be more of a profession, that it had to be neutral on the news pages, and opinion should be kept for the editorial pages. And he worked his entire life to make that come true, and he made a lot of progress. And he and his allies and those who believed the same thing in journalism, we were doing rather well during and after World War II in moving toward a better journalism. But then something happened. You could really put different dates and different events that occurred that changed that. There was something in the 60s called the New Journalism, where journalism was supposed to be the idea with that journalism was not really supposed to report the news, but was supposed to improve the society. And included in that was the idea that stories should not be based on fact, but be based on a higher level of fact, which gives you the ethical basis, tells you who's right and who's wrong, and that we should not be neutral. The reporting of the Vietnam War, I think by common consent, was inadequate. And contained too much opinion that turned out to be wrong. You had a first generation of journalism that was almost all college educated. At one time, you didn't have to go to college to be a journalist. Many did not. They got a job on a newspaper as a copy boy or a copy girl and worked their way up from there. Then it became almost required that you be a college graduate. And I'm not so sure that was a good move, because a lot of people who really understand what's going on in a community may not have gone to college. Then the other thing that occurred, and I think it probably was the biggest thing, was the revolutionary attitude of the 1960s, and especially the Vietnam War. It became very divisive, and a lot of journalistic institutions kind of forgot the basic lessons of the craft and began to take sides. And news stories began to appear that seemed to have as their objective more to convince people to believe a certain way than to inform people. And I think it's gone on from there. You have several generations of college graduates since then, educated in increasingly left-wing universities, and ultimately that has to have an effect. It has to have an effect, and I think that's what you're seeing. It's very dangerous. It's very bad for democracy. As you said, people have to be able to trust the reporter that they are dealing with, or the newspaper or the news organization. I should also add to that, very importantly, the development of television journalism. I mean, before 1950, about, people read newspapers. That was where they got their news, or they listened to the radio, and radio reporters were, for the most part, people who had newspaper training. And they began to hear broadcasts, often presented in a very formal manner, as with Edward R. Murrow, who reported from the war fronts of Europe, from London in particular, and gave descriptions of what was actually happening. And they were descriptions. It was news. When television started to come along and television news began to become the dominant form of informing the American people, something went with it. And that was the newspaper training. Many new journalists got their start in television news, where in-depth, going in-depth in the story means spending more than 30 seconds on it. And we got these quick stories with a lot of pictures. Stations began to compete on news, and news became increasingly entertainment. The phrase, if it bleeds, it leads, came into the journalistic vocabulary. If it's a crime story, it goes up front. And the profession of journalism was influenced then by ratings and by the need for journalists to look a certain way, to be pretty or handsome. And it became, I remember when I started in journalism, the complaints about broadcast news, you know, the pretty boys, they would call them, or they called them the talent. The people delivering the news were called the talent. And increasingly, we got talent who had never read a book. Now, that wasn't everybody, to be sure. That wasn't everybody. There were some and are some fine television journalists. But it became a medium that the stories were too short to tell the whole story. Somebody once noted that the entire content of the CBS Evening News could fit on one page of a newspaper. So people were not getting the feature stories, the community stories, the background stories, and things were diminished. Another observation that was made at the time, as television news began to dominate, that the books written by journalists were getting shorter and shorter because they were being written by television journalists for whom a page is a whole volume. It's like the Old Testament. You know, you write a page, you've written the Bible. And that old newspaper training, that shoe leather reporting, that going into depth, knowing the city that you're reporting on, knowing the police, kind of went out the window.
They did. And of course, for me, now looking at, I was going to say, looking at the media, to follow up on what you said, this is killing the media too, because their ratings are in the tank. The networks are losing audiences. People are not watching the news. I mean, I know still millions do, but it's nowhere near. I just heard today that Walter Cronkite, 28 million people used to watch him at 5:30.
Yes.
Or 6:30.
Yes.
6 million people watch the CBS News now. So, I mean, that's a big drop in ratings. But I think the biggest thing specifically that's happened over the last 4 years in driving the media down, Bill, or the ratings or the credibility, is the Trump presidency, the way the media reacted to it. And look, there's always – I mean, look, we've talked before about President Trump's character and his explosive nature. That's all true. But that's not the problem. The problem is they were, you know, printing and doing stories about things like Russia, and it seems like any criticism of Trump was given immediate credibility. There wasn't anybody at the network or at the newsroom who would say, wait a minute, is it really true that a 10-year-old girl got pregnant and had to go to Indiana to get an abortion? Is that really true before we go on the air with that? Apparently they didn't check that story, Bill.
Well, the level of checking is very poor, especially in television news. The level of inquiry, the inquisitiveness of journalists, I think, leaves a great deal to be desired. The idea that a CNN could come along and really, really lower the standards of television news. They have very good people at CNN. There are a lot of people who have good backgrounds, but under this chap who just was shown the door, CNN became basically the anti-Trump network. And we didn't need an anti-Trump network. We port the news, and we also had the emotionalization of news, where a journalist would go on the air, or a pseudo journalist would say, "We now bring you the emotional story of Betty and Connie." I always like to talk back to the television set because that's what happens after a while. And I said, "Don't tell me it's an emotional story. Tell me the story. I will decide on the emotion." Now, you know, Arthur Hayes Sulzberger, who was not a man I particularly admired, but he was the publisher of the New York Times, had a very good phrase about this, and here I do agree with him. He said, "We'll tell you which way the cat is jumping It's your job to take care of the cat. And he was right.
Right.
It is up to the press to tell you what is happening. It's up to the people to decide on what they want to do about it.
That's right. That's right. No, you're right. And the media has really gone off the track. I don't know if it can survive this. I mean, there will always be media, but I think you're going to see a lot of media people looking for jobs because they are losing a lot of ratings. Well, I'm going to leave us or end today with what I think it's a fun story. This is something that I found interesting. But on this day, Bill, in 1914, George Herman Ruth made his major league debut. Now, back then he was known as George Herman Ruth, not Babe Ruth. And, of course, he became the Babe, and you know that story. But I just thought it was interesting when I was looking at 1914 and that he made a debut in 1914, I said to myself, who would have believed that this George Herman Ruth, who's making his pitching debut with the Red Sox, a couple of years later you had the big White Sox scandal, and then it would be this guy, George Herman Ruth, now named Babe, who would save the game of baseball. I just thought it was interesting. Who would have ever believed that in 1914 when he made his major league debut, Bill? Maybe a baseball fan like me can think about this, but in 1914, who would have known that this guy would save the game 5 years later, Bill?
That's right, and you know Yankee Stadium was called the house that Ruth built.
Yes.
And it was because of his incredible record as a player. Now, he was a... He was a Babe Ruth was not a pure human being. He was a real party guy. When I was on the New York Times, I sat in one part of my time there, I sat next to a photographer named Sam Falk, a legendary New York Times photographer who used to carouse with Babe Ruth. Babe Ruth was a close friend of his, and the stories he told were wonderful. He said, Babe, we would stay out all night. He got not 1 minute of sleep. He'd get up the next day and hit 2 home runs. I mean, he just had this phenomenal strength.
Right.
He couldn't run. If you ever saw pictures of Babe Ruth running, I mean, for him, a trip from first to third was an overnight trip. He was that slow, but he hit that ball as nobody could hit it, and he was a beloved character. He really was. I remember the day he died. There was really national mourning because he was seen as a symbol of the national pastime, and he always came through. His career ended sadly. You know, he was traded, and they didn't know what to do with him because they didn't feel he had the ability to manage a team. But he just kind of faded away. But he made some movies, which were wonderful. I mean, there are little scenes in movies that Babe Ruth made when he goes into a school and says, what are you boys, you kids all doing studying? There's baseball to be played. And he had that goony-looking face. He looked like who he was, like a goony guy. And they made the Babe Ruth story in the early 1940s with William Bendix as Babe Ruth. Now, William Bendix later went on to fame as Riley in the radio and television programs, The Life of Riley. And there's a wonder. So they made him Babe Ruth. Now, there was a wonderful side story to that. If we have a few seconds, William Bendix, the actor, as a young boy, was a bat boy at Yankee Stadium and knew Babe Ruth. And years later, he played him in the movie. Very little known story.
You know, in that series that Ken Burns made about baseball, it's a great, great series, great documentary. They have a lot of these Babe Ruth films, you know, from the late 20s, early 30s.
Yes, sure.
And one thing about the Babe he got drunk the night before. But he was always great with the kids. People forget that. He was wonderful with kids.
Yeah, wonderful.
I mean,
wonderful.
He would never turn down an autograph or a photo. And what I find amazing as a baseball fan, and someone who tried to play baseball, I guess we always do, we all do one way or another, but he would go out and get drunk. The game was at 1 o'clock. They used to play at 1 o'clock back then or 12 o'clock. I mean, they didn't have the whole afternoon to rest before the night game. I don't even think Babe Ruth played a night game in his career, and yet he was able to get to the park, literally put on the uniform, go out there and, like you say, hit 2 home runs. That's pretty impressive. And maybe he had to hit home runs, Bill, because he couldn't get around to hitting a double. He probably would have been thrown out at second base if he hit doubles.
He was a character. He was a character at a time when the game had characters. You know,
yes.
They had personalities. You knew them. You felt that you knew them. There were other guys with even stranger personalities. But Babe Ruth, he had the numbers. You know, and
yes.
He had that wonderful comment. I think the year was about 1930, when it was noted that his salary was higher than that of the President of the United States. You know, and he was asked by a reporter, how come your salary is higher than the President? And his answer was, I had a better year than he did.
That's it. I mean, how can you beat that answer? I mean, how do you beat that answer? But I thought you would appreciate me bringing out Babe Ruth here at the end, because I just thought it was remarkable. He makes his debut in 1914 and literally saves the game in the next 5 to 6 years, because the game was in a real crisis after that White Sox scandal. And it took Babe Ruth to put people back in the seats. And that's, to me, that's his greatest contribution to the game, that he saved the professional, not the game itself, the game would have always existed, but the professional side of the game, with people actually paying for the ticket, that was the crisis because of the White Sox scandal, and he saved the game. Well, Bill, I just want to thank you so much, as always, especially your story about Babe Ruth. I want to thank you again for joining us and being a part of it. All I can say is I look forward to the next time, because there's always interesting to hear from you when we get together, Bill.
We have a good time, and I'll look forward to next week, and I'm sure we'll have plenty to talk about.
Yeah, go to the bodega and get yourself a nice cigar. I think they still sell them.
I never smoked a cigar, but I will. Okay.
Check it out. All right. Talk to you later. Our good friend Bill Katz, the editor of Urgent Agenda. Thank you so much, Bill.
My pleasure.
Bye-bye. Well, thank you for listening. That was a great story about Babe Ruth there at the end. I loved it. Thank you for listening. This is Silvio Canto in Dallas, 101 degrees as I chat with you in the mid-afternoon. That's the way it is around here. I think Walter Cronkite said something like that. Bye-bye, everybody.